Hello, and welcome to Creation Matters with your host, Mike Riddle, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live. Mike is an author, teacher, and conference speaker, and is president of Christian Training and Development Services. Creation Matters is dedicated to the teaching of the biblical and scientific truths about God's creation. In the beginning, God created, and for by Him were all things created. And now here's your host of Creation Matters, Mike Riddle.
Welcome to another edition of Creation Matters. This is your host, Mike Riddle, from Oregon today. We've just finished a speaking tour from Idaho to California, and we're on our way back, but we needed to stop to make sure we could get the show on today. And our topic today is, do you believe in evolution? Now, I want to caution you. Before you answer that question, I want to let you know the question, do you believe in evolution, is a trick question. And if you have any concerns about that, give us a call at 800-955-8200. Now, why is a simple little question like, do you believe in evolution, a trick question? Well, it happens to be because many of our textbooks use two kinds of evolution. They use two different words. One is called microevolution, and the other one is macroevolution. And the common perception we're getting is that microevolution, meaning small changes, can lead to large changes called macroevolution. Do you believe that? If we can have microevolution against small, little, tiny changes, over a long period of time, will that lead to large changes, allowing one species to become a new species? Again, do small changes lead to large changes over time? This is the claim by evolutionists and what we read in textbooks. Well, when you are faced with that question, do you believe in evolution? We shouldn't answer that question right away. We should be asking a question. In other words, we need to define our terms before we get into any discussion. What do you mean by evolution? You know, when I ask that question, most evolutionists cannot give me a straight answer. Why is that? Why is it that most evolutionists cannot give a straight answer to what evolution is? Well, part of that is we're not defining our terms anymore in most books. So let's get started here with some definitions so we can all be on the same foot and understand what evolution really is. Well, first of all, let's start with the term macroevolution. Now, what is macroevolution? That is what we normally refer to as Darwinian evolution. That is the idea that one species can change into a completely new species, a large change. This would be like an amphibian growing legs and becoming a reptile, or a reptile growing feathers and becoming a bird, or an ape-like creature becoming a human being. That's what we mean by macroevolution. And by the way, that has never, ever been observed. The fossil record completely refutes macroevolution. Then there's another term that we kind of fuzzy around in our textbook. It's called natural selection. Now, as a creationist and Christian, I do believe in natural selection. We see that all the time. Natural selection's all around us. What does it mean? Well, a lot of it means our ability to adapt to our environment. Sometimes we might see it as survival of the fittest. So we do see that all the time. Natural selection is true. It is observable, whereas macroevolution is not observable. Now, the question is, can natural selection cause one kind or species to become a new kind? See, this is one of the main mechanisms of evolution, natural selection. Can it cause evolution to take place? You know the answer to that is no. Very simple. It is no. You see, natural selection can only work with existing information. It can only select from what already exists. It never, never adds anything new. And in order for evolution, we have to add new information into our genes. Now, also, natural selection in many cases causes a loss of information. In other words, it's going the wrong way. And also, natural selection has no foresight into the future. It has no idea where it's going. In other words, if you were to take the eye, how in the world would an eye ever get started from nothing? Natural selection doesn't know where it's going to end. It just selects from already exist. So natural selection, can it cause evolution? The answer is no. We are teaching that very fuzzy in the school systems and just going off and say natural selection is one of the mechanisms for evolution, and it is not. No scientist in the world can support that. Well, let's go to another term. How about the term genetic variability? You know, God has programmed into every species the capability to be variable. You just look at the dog kind, the canines. We have over 300 different kinds or types of dogs, but you know, they're all dogs. The DNA says every one of them's a dog. A Great Dane is a dog. You know, even a poodle is classified as a dog. I know some of you might take exception, but that is a dog. So we have many flavors of dogs. We have little dogs, medium-sized dogs, large dogs. We have fuzzy dogs, short-haired dogs, but they are all dogs. God has done the same thing in the horse family, in the cat family. Even in human beings, we have tremendous genetic variability within the human species, but we are all humans. We have tall humans, we have short humans. We have humans with different colors, but we're all humans. We have humans with different shapes of eyes, but we are all humans. It is called genetic variability. Now, a fourth term would be something called microevolution. Now, microevolution is commonly used to talk about small steps. Now, I want to point something out here about that word. We don't need this word. It is a deceptive word used to promote and to trick people into accepting evolution as true, when in fact, it has nothing to do with evolution. See, it is supposed to mean small changes, but we already have words for this. They're called natural selection or genetic variability or mutations. So why do we have the word microevolution? To trick and deceive people into understanding or believing evolution, where it has nothing to do with evolution. Again, it means our genetic variability, natural selection, or mutations. Now, we do have mutations, and that's another term. Now, what are mutations? Well, when you go to the medical journals, they're classified as changes in our DNA. Changes in our DNA. We can have insertions into our DNA. We can have deletions out of our DNA. We can invert parts of our DNA. We can duplicate part of our DNA. We can even recombine parts of our DNA. And we can even have parts of our DNA come out of one part and go to another part in our DNA. All of those are considered changes in the DNA. They are considered to be mutations. Now, can mutations cause evolution? Well, let me give you a quote. Now, this quote comes from two different people. One gentleman has his PhD in genetics, and the other one has his PhD in molecular and cell biology. And this is what they have to say about this. Mutations, or genetic variation and recombination by themselves, will not generate major evolutionary change. Well, there you have a gentleman who's got his PhD in genetics, and another gentleman who has his PhD in cellular biology, and both of them will state, based on all their observation and all their background in science, mutations do not cause evolution. Well, isn't that strange? That seems to be opposite of what we're being taught in our textbooks. You know, when I do the research and I look at what the scientists are really saying and what we have in our textbooks, there seems to be a major difference between our textbooks and education and what the scientists actually know to be true. That means we need to have some major changes in our education system, and we need to get back to teaching science in the science classroom. Well, let me take a look at some cases that have been commonly used to promote evolution, and they call these microevolution, to promote evolution again. Now remember, microevolution, meaning small changes, really has nothing to do with evolution. But here's how they use it in our textbooks. The first one is called the peppered moth. Now for many, many decades, they used this peppered moth as support of evolution because they said it was small micro changes. Now here's how it worked. Before the Industrial Revolution, we had peppered moths. We had dark-colored peppered moths, and we had light-colored peppered moths. And they like to supposedly land on the bark on trees. Now, birds like to eat these peppered moths. And when they landed on the trees, they landed on trees that were light-colored. So So the light-colored pepper moths blended in, and the dark ones were easy to see. So the birds would see the dark ones and eat them up. That means we had a larger population of light-colored peppered moths because they were camouflaged. Then here comes the Industrial Revolution. All kinds of carbons and soot come out, and it gets into the trees and turns the trees darker. Now the dark-colored pepper moths blend in with the trees, and they're harder to see by the birds. So the birds see the light ones and start eating them up. And we have a population change. Now we have more dark-colored pepper moths than light-colored pepper moths. And this was considered to be proof of evolution. Well, here's your basic question, folks. What did we start with? Light-colored pepper moths and dark-colored pepper moths. What did we end with? Light-colored pepper moths and dark-colored pepper moths. Where is the evolution in there? What changed? It was just a population change. It's called natural selection, survival of the fittest in our ability to adapt to our environment, which has nothing, absolute nothing to do with evolution. We need to get educated on science, not some philosophy that does not understand science. Well, let's look at another famous case that was commonly considered microevolution, evolution happening before our eyes. It's called the fruit flies. What they did with these fruit flies is they bombarded them with radiation to simulate millions of years of mutations. Well, you know what we ended up with? Fruit flies with different color eyes, fruit flies with deformed wings, and fruit flies with no wings. What did we start with, folks? Fruit flies. What did we end up with? Fruit flies that were less viable to live. Where is the evolution there? You see, we need to understand science. We need to get our education back on route with science, not some philosophy that is opposed to science. Why can't we just teach science for what it is? We start with pepper moths, we end with pepper moths. We started with fruit flies, we end it with fruit flies. Well, let's take another famous case that has been commonly used to support evolution, and they call this microevolution again. Finches, Darwin's finches. Darwin studied the finches over there in the Galapagos Islands, and he noticed that some of these finches, some of the populations got isolated. And some of these finches developed short beaks, fat beaks, long beaks, and different sized beaks. And he concluded, this is an example of evolution. Well, we still teach that in our textbooks. We still teach it in our education system as evolution, when in fact, it has nothing to do with evolution. Absolutely nothing to do with evolution. And when we come back from this break, I'm going to tell you why it has nothing to do with evolution and why we are being deceived, and it really has everything to do with natural selection. And if you want to answer any questions about microevolution, macroevolution, give us a call at 800-955-8200, or you can go out to our website, creationmatters.org. So after the break, we're going to answer that question, what do finches really support? Welcome back to Creation Matters. This is your host, Mike Riddle, and today we're talking about genetics. Is it the friend of creation, or is it the friend of evolution? So far we've been talking about terms like microevolution and macroevolution, and we talked about the peppered moths that had nothing to do with evolution, fruit flies had nothing to do with evolution, and we've just discussed the finches, how Darwin looked at the finches and how they saw small beaks, short beaks, fat beaks, and we still present that in our textbooks as proof of evolution, when in fact it has absolutely nothing to do with evolution. See, we need to learn to be critical thinkers. We need to examine things and not just accept them. You see, those finches that Darwin talked about, and we still talk about in our textbooks and classrooms, what they don't tell you. See, here's the problem. We're not telling our students everything. Those finches got their beak sizes because they got isolated into groups because of a drought that occurred. But when that drought was over, these finches got back together again, and their beaks went back to essentially the same sizes. What they also don't tell you is that these finches, even though they had different size beaks, very slight different sizes, they made it. See, one of the things that they commonly tell us in our textbooks is these finches didn't mate, therefore they're a separate species. That is absolutely not true. That is ignoring the scientific evidence. These finches did mate, and they produced fertile offspring. So the question again is, what did we start with? Finches. What did we end with, folks? Finches. Where is the evolution in that? You see, these are just basic, simple questions that our children are not being allowed to ask. And let's take another case here. This is probably the best evolution has to offer. Absolutely the best evolution has to offer. Antibiotic resistant. Antibiotic resistance. We have bacteria becoming resistant to our best antibiotics. And we are told that is evolution happening right in front of our eyes. When in fact, that is not true, folks. We need to get back to good science in our education system. See, here's the problem. Some of these bacteria already have the resistance, and some don't. The ones that don't have the resistance die out. What did we start with? Bacteria. What did we end with? Bacteria. And in some case, we have what is called a horizontal gene transfer. One of the genes might be transferred from one bacteria to another bacteria. And in that case, it does get a resistance. But the question is, where did that original gene come from? You see, we don't think about that. We're not thinking anymore, folks. We need to get back to thinking and asking good questions. Learn to be better scientists rather than just what accept this thing called evolutionism. And here's another one. In the 1800s, frozen explorers were uncovered. And great care was taken. And you know what we found in those frozen explorers from the 1800s? They already contained, the bacteria in them already had the resistance to our best antibiotics. So nothing new has ever been created. That resistance has already been there. And then here's a recent one we've discovered. Sometimes we have two sets of genes that program for the same function. And sometimes those genes will just swap back and forth in our DNA. It is called a programmed gene expression. Programmed gene expression. In other words, that happens in salmonella and it happens in E. coli. These genes, two genes coding for the same function. One is dominant and the other is recessive. And they'll switch back and forth. The one that's recessive will become the active one, and the one that's active will become the recessive one. And that can cause a resistance. The question is, was anything new added there? Absolutely not. You see, evolution requires random mutations, and what we're finding out, a lot of these mutations are not random. The information has always been there. But you know, we have journals and magazines like Unscientific American, and I use that very generously, Unscientific American magazine. Let me read a quote from them. And they make this statement. They say, on the contrary, biology has cataloged many traits produced by mutations, changes at precise positions in an organism's DNA. Then they say bacteria resistance to antibiotics, for example, and they call that evolution. Well, see, here's what they're not telling you in the Unscientific American magazine. The issue is not new traits, folks, but new genetic information. You see, new traits can arise through loss of genetic information. In some cases, genes are switched on in the wrong place, such as legs. You see, we've actually had legs grow out of these fruit flies' heads. Is that something better? See, the information to grow those legs was already there, so it's not new information. In no known case has new genetic information been confirmed. So watch out for tricks like that. They're saying new traits. It's not a matter of new traits. It's a matter of new genetic information. So when we talk about genetics, folks, we're mostly talking about something called DNA. So let's get down to this genetics and DNA. How is evolution supposed to work? Let's get down to the very basic part of this. How is evolution supposed to work? We've talked about some terms now, microevolution, macroevolution, genetic variation, mutations, and natural selection. Let's put it all together now, and how is evolution supposed to work? Well, first thing we're supposed to have is a beneficial mutation. Then natural selection selects this mutation over any existing genes or other detrimental mutations that code for this function. Then that mutation is inherited by the offspring. Now again, mutations are changes in the DNA. But evolution requires what are called random mutations as the ultimate source of all genetic information. In other words, these random mutations are supposed to take a fish to an amphibian, or a reptile to a bird, or an ape to a human. Well, what do we know about mutations? Well, there's different types of mutations. There are detrimental mutations, neutral mutations, and some recognized beneficial mutations. Now, what do we know about detrimental mutations? Well, detrimental mutations cause disease, sickness, and death. You know what we know about dead things? They simply don't evolve, do they, folks? So there's no evolution with detrimental mutations. They're going the wrong way. Now, there are a lot of mutations that are neutral, but neutral mutations don't add anything, so no evolution there. Now, there are a few recognized beneficial mutations. They're very, very rare and hard to find, but there are some recognized ones. But, folks, a beneficial mutation does not cause evolution. Let's get this straight right now. Let's make sure our education system gets this straight, folks. Beneficial mutations do not cause evolution. See, it has to be a beneficial mutation that adds new genetic information. If it doesn't add new information, it cannot be evolution. You see, if we have a computer, if we have just bought a brand new computer, and all we have on that computer is an operating system, cannot do anything but turn on and turn off, and you decide you want to do some word processing, what do you have to do to that computer? You have to add new information into that computer called a word processor. That is the same thing for how evolution needs to work. They have to add new genetic information. It has to be beneficial, folks. So we need to make sure we don't get caught into that trap of just having beneficial mutations causing evolution. Now, to give you an idea about all this, let me go through a case study. And remember, evolution is based on random mutation. Let's start with a single cell, because that's how evolution is supposed to have started. And incidentally, we have no scientific mechanism for what could cause that first cell. It is scientifically not possible. But let's say we start with one cell. Now, we need to go from a single cell up to human being, because that's what evolution says happened, a single cell up to human being. Then, you know, humans contain about 60 trillion cells. So we have to go from one cell to 60 trillion cells in 3.5 billion years. Did you know, if we do the math on this, that would take over 17,000 cell additions per year for 3.5 billion years. What mechanism could ever cause this to happen, folks? That is impossible. What mechanism would cause 17,000 cell additions per year, and they all have to be beneficial and go to the exact right place? You see, we're never trained to think like that. We're just trained to say, oh, evolution happened. Folks, let's get back to science. Let's get back to thinking. We don't seem to want to do that when it comes to evolution. You see, each cell, every single cell, is more complex than our best computers. Now, does anybody out there believe computers happen by random chance over long periods of time? Now, I know they can act that way, folks, but that's not how they got there. Cells, a single cell is more complex than any computer we've ever built, folks. Now, inside each cell is something called DNA. You know that DNA contains more information, is more compact than our biggest hard drives and our biggest DVDs? Now, DNA is an information code, and it contains vast amounts of information. More information than we can put in all the encyclopedias goes in one DNA molecule. How did that happen? Where does all this information come from? Now, we come back from the break. I'm going to give you some very common sense pieces of information about genetics and DNA. We just need to get back to basic common sense. And common sense, folks, says evolution is impossible. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get good common sense back into our science classroom? So when we come back, some common sense about DNA and genetics. And again, if you have a question, give us a call, 800-955-8200. 800-955-8200. Welcome back to Creation Matters. This is your host, Mike Riddle. You know, over the last several months, on this show, Creation Matters, we've given many, many scientific evidences why evolution is simply not possible. And you know there's only two ways we could have gotten here. Either we evolved or we were created specially by God. And if evolution is scientifically impossible, folks, that means there's only one choice left. And that means in the beginning, God created. And we were created in the image and likeness of God. We were created very special, folks. And that's what we want our next generation to understand, that we were created with a purpose, and we were created special, folks. Now, again, I'm coming to you from Oregon this week. We just had a wonderful tour in Idaho and California, and we're on our way back, and we'll be home for just a few days. And next week, I'll be coming to you from a place called New York, where I'll be teaching a college course for a week there. But did you know, all the evidence we give, we need your support. You know, we have an offer on the table right now for the whole month of May that for every dollar you contribute to help keep this show on, he will duplicate that dollar. So if you'd like to help support this show through the month of May, every dollar you donate, it will be matched. And if you want to learn how to donate, go to the website creationmatters.org. Creationmatters.org and help support this radio show. And also, coming in June, about the middle of June, we will be moving to Kentucky to be full-time with Answers in Genesis. But, you know, Answers in Genesis said they would be more than happy to keep the radio show if we could get it paid for. So if you have an interest in continuing this kind of teaching, give us a call or let us know and help support this radio ministry so that we can protect this next generation. Now, I'd like to give you just a little rundown on some of the things that have happened on this recent trip that we've just finished up. We just came from Seaside or Monterey, California, and I did a series of talks there. You know, we had many scientists in the audience. We had a gentleman who had his Ph.D. in physics. We had a gentleman who had two master's degrees in mathematics and had almost finished his Ph.D. in mathematics. We had a gentleman who helped build the Hubble telescope and still consults on that issue, and we had many other scientists and theologians there. And did you know every one of them believed in a literal six-day creation about 6,000 years ago? Isn't that wonderful? Scientists are starting to understand that in the beginning God created, and that evolution is just not a scientific viable option. It could never happen, folks, and that's what we're talking about today. Genetics. And before we went on that break, I said, I'm going to give you some common sense genetics, some common sense science. Well, let's start here. Here's a simple question. How does an acorn know it has to grow into an oak tree and not a sunflower? You ever stop? That's a simple question, isn't it? How does an acorn know it has to grow into an oak tree and not a sunflower? Or how does a chicken know it has to grow? How does a little chick inside that egg know it has to grow into a chicken and not a duck? How does it know that? Well, the answer is information. Information. And the big question is, where does all that information come from? Did you know information does not arise by natural processes? Information only arises by intelligent sources. No known mechanism has ever caused information to arise by itself. Let me read you a simple quote here. Simple quote. Now, this quote comes from a gentleman who's got his Ph.D. in physics and headed up the whole area of Germany for many years in physics and technology. He's also one of the top information scientists in the world. And this is what he has to say about this. Quote, there is no known law of nature, no known process, and no known sequence of events which can cause information to originate by itself in matter. That means, folks, that information must come from an intelligent source, not evolution, which is random chances, random occurrences. Now, let's go back to this common sense here. Let me give you a common mistake regarding DNA and information that's used in our schools, and it's called the caterpillar to the butterfly. Caterpillar turning into a butterfly. This is often used as an example to promote evolution. But in fact, it has nothing to do with evolution. Let me tell you the whole scenario. First of all, let's talk about the monarch butterfly. This is an amazing case here, folks. Do you know the caterpillar reaches full maturity 20 days after the egg is laid. So after 20 days, we have a complete mature caterpillar. You know, it grows from about 0.08 inches to about 1.8 inches in length. And its weight increases 2,700 times. It increases its weight in those 20 days 2,700 times. This would be equivalent to a 6-pound baby growing to 16,000 pounds in 20 days. Can you imagine that? How would you like to carry that baby around in your backpack? Now, approximately after the 20th day, this caterpillar stops eating and begins to look for a suitable place to spin a silk pad. Now, it finds a special place to build this silk pad, and it takes about 6 hours to make this little silk pad. Then the caterpillar attaches its two hind legs to this silk pad and hangs with its head in a J position. Then the caterpillar remains in this position for about 12 hours and then begins the cyclic little behavior or movements. Once it starts to move again, this is a sign that a transformation is about to happen. Now the transformation, now this is amazing, folks. This is really something. This transformation begins from the head to the bottom and takes only 60 seconds. In other words, the caterpillar is totally blind while this is happening. It is totally blind while it's building this chrysalis, which we normally call a cocoon. Can you imagine that? It builds this cocoon blinded in 60 seconds. Now remember, this caterpillar is about 1.8 inches long, but you know this chrysalis or cocoon is only about 1 inch long, about half the size of the caterpillar. That's the other amazing thing. Now here is where it really gets amazing. You think that was good. It gets even more amazing here, this caterpillar. The caterpillar, once it is inside this cocoon, disintegrates itself into a green liquid. The whole caterpillar disintegrates itself into a green liquid. The only internal part that remains is the heart, which is beating about 60 times per minute. And then finally, after being in there 8 days, it reappears as a butterfly. Wow, what an amazing scenario here. And that's exactly how a caterpillar turns into a butterfly. Now let's go back and see how this evolutionary scenario might have happened. First of all, the caterpillar has to evolve the materials to make a cocoon. Where did it get that information? See, we're just leaving all of this out of our science classes and turning our science, folks, into magic. Voodoo magic. That's what evolution has to resort to. Why can't we just teach science? So first of all, it has to evolve the materials to make a cocoon. That's a lot of information to know how to build a cocoon, folks. And then it has to develop some enzyme or process to dissolve all its tissues into a green liquid. Now think of this. Here's the first caterpillar somehow learns to build a cocoon, then dissolves itself into a green liquid. What happens next, folks? You see, think of yourself in evolutionary terms. What happens after it dissolved itself into a green liquid? Do you know what would happen? It stays a soupy green liquid forever. You see, evolution just doesn't work, folks. It, once it's a green liquid, it can't eat, can't drink, can't reproduce. It just stays a green liquid. Unless it already has programmed into it, into its DNA, the instructions to change that green liquid into a complex flying insect called a butterfly. You see, right there, folks, is complete proof that evolution cannot be true. All that information has to be programmed into that caterpillar before it ever begins. How would a caterpillar know it has to build a cocoon, change itself into a green liquid, and then recombine itself into a butterfly, folks? That right there shows the impossibility of evolution. Another one we commonly teach as evolution is the tadpole turning into a frog. This again has nothing to do with evolution. It has everything to do with information. Where did the original information in the DNA come from to change that tadpole into a frog? The whole concept of information is being left out of our discussion. However, it is critical. You see, information is critical to understanding biology. We cannot understand biology if we don't understand information. That's why it's being left out of our biology classroom, because information, folks, destroys the whole concept of evolution, because information never, never arises by random chance processes. And we're going to take another short break here. When we come back, I want to talk more about DNA, a tremendous molecule out there that is evidence that in the beginning, God created. Again, if you have some questions, give us a call, 800-955-8200. And if you would like to support this continued teaching and help protect our children and get the truth of science, go to our website, creationmatters.org, and you can see how to help support this ministry, Creation Matters. And we'll be back in just a moment to talk more about DNA and just good common sense and education. Welcome back to Creation Matters. This is your host, Mike Riddle, and we're talking about genetics. And what we're finding out, it is the friend of creation and the enemy of evolution. And again, genetics, a friend of creation, an enemy of evolution, and we've gone through quite a few things already. And we have a caller on the line, John from Bellevue. Welcome to the show, John.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the peppered moth. And your comment about it was very valid about the peppered moth not being relevant for evolution, but in fact it's worse than that. It turns out that peppered moths don't even rest on the tree trunk at all.
That's right. The whole thing was a mistake from the beginning, wasn't it?
It was. They pasted it on the tree trunks. It was a fraud.
That's what I would like to say, too. It was a fraud. I like your choice of words there, John.
But it shows you when somebody wants to believe in something strong enough that manipulating the evidence doesn't matter because they believed it happened. They just wanted to show it.
Well, I appreciate that a lot, John.
And I'm a mathematician, and I can say, like you say, the information theory is not created by evolution at all. It just mutations cannot create information. I was deceived in that at Berkeley when I was studying anthropology and before I was a creationist and thinking that somehow that this variation could somehow account for evolution, but they have to believe it happened before to make the parts.
That's right, John. I agree 100%. And with your PhD in mathematics, you have a lot of background. And Berkeley, is that in the United States?
Yeah, right. But the point when in anthropology they said that horse toes change from 3 to 2 to 1 toe, and that has nothing to do with evolution either. That's devolution, even if it occurred.
That's right. What we see happening is we're going the wrong way. We have so many mutations and genetic load on us, folks. We're going the wrong way. Thank you, John.
Okay.
God bless you for that.
Bye-bye.
Now you heard it. A gentleman who's got study and PhD in mathematics and anthropology from Berkeley and was deceived and then came to know Christ and learned the truth about God's creation, that it was God that created everything. He created the information, and information cannot arise by random chance processes. Wow. What a great testimony there. Thank you again, John. Well, let's do some more on DNA. Now, let's get back to this evolution thing. You know, it requires random mutations, but not all mutations are random. But evolution requires random mutations as the mechanism for new information. But can random mutations really create new genetic information? Now, first of all, did you know science is based on observation? We have tended to get away from that. We just go off and think things can happen versus observing. But has anyone ever observed random mutations creating new genetic information? The answer is no. That should rule out information as a science right there, because information evolution requires random mutations, and information does not come from random mutations. Every example we perform using random changes always causes a downhill movement the wrong way. Let's take the book example. Let's use a book for example. We can compare a book with random mutations. Now, if you start with a book, an author writes a book, and you just randomly start changing letters in the book, what's going to happen? It's not going to get better, folks. It's going to go downhill. It's going to become so bad after a while, it's going to be unreadable. That is what we observe. Let's take a computer, because I know we have a lot of computer people out there. We take our operating system. Let's suppose we hired some programmers who didn't know any. Let's say we don't hire programmers. Let's suppose we hire some people that don't know anything about computers, and we just tell them to start making changes in the operating system. Random changes. They just start adding new code randomly in the operating system. What's going to happen to that computer? It's not going to work. You see, random events always go downhill. They never produce what evolution claims. So evolution has never been observed. When a cell, now let's go to a cell. Do you know when a cell is replicated, it doesn't do a perfect job. Errors do occur. But can these errors cause a reptile to grow feathers and become a bird? Well, what we've just seen is random mutations, random events, always tend to go backwards. Now, even though these errors do occur, did you know something about our cells? They are amazing, folks. They are absolutely amazing. You know, our cells have a proofreading process in them, which reduces the errors. Now, the error rate that we have ends up being about 1 per 100 billion. 1 per 100 billion is the error rate. This is like typing 50 million pages on your computer and only having one error. That means there's simply not enough errors in there to cause evolution to occur. That right there shows evolution can't occur. Now, why in the world? Think about this. Here's some common sense. Why would evolution create a proofreading mechanism to take away evolution? See, the whole proofreading process prevents evolution from occurring. So why would evolution produce a mechanism to prevent evolution? You see, common sense does not work. Let me go back and now I want to read some quotes from top scientists. Now, this gentleman has his PhD in physics from MIT and taught information and communications at Johns Hopkins University. This is what he has to say. But in all the reading I've done in the life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information. Here's another gentleman who has his PhD in molecular biology. And he says, but there is no evidence that DNA mutations can provide the sorts of variation needed for evolution. There is no evidence for beneficial mutations at the level of macroevolution, but there's also no evidence at the level that's regarded as microevolution. Now, here's another gentleman. He's a medical doctor, and he says, as a scientist with training in both medicine and physics, it is easily apparent to me that the majesty of God is revealed in the human body. Folks, what we see happening in the education system is not right. Let me read to you Romans 1:18. Romans 1:18 gives us a start. Did you know the evolutions themselves are telling us exactly what happens in the Bible? It is good information about what's happening in the Bible. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Folks, we have suppression of the truth out there. Let's get back to understanding that in the beginning God created and that He loves you and that He died on the cross for you and His mercy and grace is sufficient to cover anything we have done, folks. That is the alternative to evolution, and that alternative is a fact. God bless all of you. In the beginning, God created.
You've been listening to Creation Matters with your host, Mike Riddle, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live. If you'd like more information on today's topic or information about Christian training and development services, simply call 425-269-3196. That's 425-269-3196. Or go to the website creationmatters.org. That's creationmatters.org. And click on the KGNW radio box. Join us next Tuesday at 6 when we'll discover and discuss the truth that for by Him all things were created. That's all right here next week on Creation Matters, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live.